From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a new group is trying to make Michigan's legislature go part-time, but some aren't so sure about the idea.
Giving a legislator, say, 2 months to do their job combined with term limits? That's a recipe for disaster.
And what our local leaders think about Michigan's right-to-work law.
I think, if anything, these results seem to say this may not be as big of an issue as it looked like it was going to be a year ago.
Plus the $1,000 challenge. How much can you carve out of your monthly spending?
For a typical middle-class kind of family, there's a lot that you can get rid of that's not particularly going to involve twisting somebody's arm.
And we will look at Santa back in the early days of Michigan. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. Should Michigan's legislature go back to part-time? 46 other states are part-time, and now a new group is pushing for it to happen here. But some argue a part-time legislature could have disastrous results. On today's show, just how much time should our lawmakers spend in Lansing? And then, just in time for your New Year's resolutions, we'll get some money advice from the Detroit News personal finance editor, Brian O'Connor. His new book is The $1,000 Challenge, How One Family Slashed Its Budget Without Moving Under a Bridge or Living on Government Cheese. But first, let's check in on Michigan's kids. A new report out today says life is not getting as good as it should for children in Michigan, even as the state crawls out of the Great Recession. Here to tell us more is Jane Zender Merrill. She's the project director for Kids Count in Michigan, part of the Michigan League for Public Policy. Welcome to the program, Jane.
Thank you, Cindy.
Well, if we could we break down the findings into three groups? Let's call it the good, the bad, and the so-so.
Okay.
So why don't we start out with the good? What findings really encouraged you in the new Kids Count report?
Probably, well, the biggest change for the better is the decline in the rate of children going into out-of-home care or foster care due to abuse, neglect. And that is a pretty dramatic decline, and we are very happy to see that. We know that there are long-term effects of removing children from their home, and often they languish in foster care. So it's very good to see that these rates are going down.
Yeah, I saw that, down 33% from 2005 mm-hmm. to 2011. What do you think is behind that?
Well, I think the department with the modified settlement agreement has been making a concerted effort to move children out of foster care. And there's a lot of research now showing the damaging effects of moving kids into foster care. So there are more efforts, perhaps, to keep kids from entering that system by providing more services to families.
I also see that there's some encouraging findings in infant mortality.
Yes. The infant mortality rate is down 12%, as is the child death rate. And we've seen continued progress in the decline of births to teens, which is very good news. It's now at 30 of every 1,000 teens. It's still almost 11,000 teenagers a year giving birth, so it's not like we can relax on that one.
Mm.
And we're seeing a definite improvement in the reading among fourth graders, reading skills. And, of course, the legislature has been considering bills around holding this age group back. So this would be a pretty big impact on this, on kids.
I'm speaking with Jane Zender Merrill, who is the project director for Kids Count in Michigan, as we look at the latest Kids Count report. Let's talk about what's so-so. Where has progress stalled out as you review?
Well, we've stalled out in terms of our low birth weight babies. It's around 8% of all births, around almost 10,000 births every year, where babies are born weighing less than 5.5 pounds. The smaller the baby, the higher the risk in terms of development, healthy development, and chronic diseases, and even the threat of death. And the other areas where we don't see a lot of improvement are on these other education indicators, which have not shifted a lot. They're all on the improvement side, but by 1%, 3%, High school students' reading has improved by 8%, but still, I mean, there's a bit of a stagnation there between 2008 and 2012.
And those eighth graders and their math proficiency is kind of stalled out too, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm. That's very worrying. Mm-hmm.
Let's move over to what indicators you feel come under the heading of bad. What most alarmed you, Jane Zender Merrill, as you looked at this Kids Count report?
The most alarming trend that we see is this persistence of child poverty. Of the three indicators that we use for economic security, the child poverty for kids 0 to 17 actually is now 34% above what it was in 2005. And we're into the recovery, according to The Economist, but clearly it is not reaching families with children. And not surprising, we see a pretty big increase in young children who have their nutritional needs met through the use of SNAP. And also we see a lot of young people in K-12 system who are eligible for free and reduced price lunch. So that's one of every two students in our public school system.
Wow.
That's living in a family qualifying for free or reduced price lunch. Over 500,000 kids in this state whose parents or families don't have income above the poverty level. And the poverty level is a very low benchmark. It's $18,000 for a family of three, which is sort of normal size for a single-parent family, and $23,000, that's gross income for a family of four with two parents, two children.
So here we have a state where the economists tell us our economy is recovering, the recession is behind us, and yet your findings for Kids Count show that pretty much every economic indicator is moving in the wrong direction in terms of kids in poverty, and also an increase in children living in families investigated for abuse or neglect?
Yes, and that's up it's up tremendously over the trend period. It's up by 41%. So economic hard times really compromise the capacity of parents to care for their children. And in previous downturns, we've had a much more robust safety net. Hmm. So the fact that we don't have those kinds of programs to tide parents through rough times is a concern. Plus, this has been the longest downturn and the least robust recovery that we've ever seen, I believe.
So this disconnect seems to be, I think I'm hearing you say, and correct me if I'm wrong, there are a lot of people who are not getting scooped up in this net of recovery.
Not at all. These are tough times for families, and we have a number of recommendations that should be considered by state policymakers. We feel it's important to reinstate and put in place some strategies that would help families get through these times.
And what would those be? What would your recommendations, if you could, you know, write a prescription and see it filled, what would that prescription look like?
We would have three to address economic insecurity. The first being restoring the state earned income tax credit, which benefits low-income working families, predominantly those with children. We had that credit at 20%. It was reduced to 6%. We'd like to see it go back up. All that money immediately enters the local economies because families need those dollars to meet basic needs. The second would be to raise the eligibility and adjust the sliding scale for the child care subsidy. One of the biggest expenses working families have is the cost of child care. Child care for one preschooler would use up almost half the net income from a full-time minimum wage job. That's just not acceptable.
And here we have parents being told, you have to get out, you have to find a job, search
exactly.
for a job, and yet you've got youngsters at home. What a catch-22.
Yes. So that would be a really important component to look at to support people who are trying to get a job, trying to do the right thing, raise their families. And the last, which is gaining a momentum around the country, is raising the minimum wage. I mean, right now, if you work full-time year-round at the minimum wage, you're $7,000 below the poverty level for a family of four. And in the late 70s, it used to be that you were over the poverty level with a minimum wage full-time job. So we need to look at that. It's just, it doesn't seem that in this country that you can work all day, full year, and yet not have enough to meet the basic needs of your family. And by the way, poverty is a very low bar.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot more than poverty level income to have your basic needs met.
So overall, if I'm going to see if you can give me a sense of this. If you were putting a grade from A to F failing for this Kids Count report and how Michigan is performing, what grade would you give Michigan?
Oh, I don't like to be harsh. I think, you know, we have seen some improvement. I would be between a D and a C. I mean, that's sort of where we are in the national rankings. We're 31st in the country, so we're sort of in that third quartile. We really, as a state, need to look at investing in the people of the state, the next generation. It won't help us if we have jobs and businesses who want to come here and we don't have an educated workforce. And we can't get to an educated workforce with so many children and families in such desperate straits.
Jane Zender Merrill, the project director for Kids Count in Michigan, part of the Michigan League for Public Policy, as we take a look at the good, the so-so, and the bad in the latest Kids Count report. Jane, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of our very favorite things to do here on Stateside is check in with our resident historian, Bill Loomis. And today we've got Bill here to tell us just what Christmas would have been like in Michigan in days past. Bill, it's pretty well accepted Charles Dickens pretty much created that Victorian Christmas that we tend to think of as Christmas, air quotes. But take us back to the earliest days of pioneers and early settlers in Detroit and Michigan.
They were doing French Christmas in the 1701 up through 1820s, really. It was still basically a French town. So they did a meat pie at night. They had a celebration called Réveillon. There was no Christmas tree, of course. That came later with the Germans. But they had a Yule log, and they would roast turkeys, wild turkeys, and sometimes geese or ducks suspended from a cord in the hearth. They had meat pies that they were basically ground meat. It started out as pigeon pies. They're called touchères.
Hmm.
They really feasted well, and brandy for the men and cordials for the ladies, and it was quite a big deal.
Then as we move from being French to being the United States of America, part of that, how did things evolve?
Christmas wasn't celebrated until about 1840 because Protestants didn't recognize Christmas. That was Catholic. Because the people that came to Detroit were coming from New England once the Erie Canal opened. And so from about 1820, mid-20s up through 1840s, there was a great emigration of New Englanders and from New York.
So that took till up to not too long before the Civil War then.
Right. It really was after the Civil War that Christmas came on strong in Detroit.
Was part of that because the whole country became enamored of Charles Dickens and A Christmas Carol?
You know, that's really true. And there, as I said, there were a lot of German immigrants that came over, and Christmas trees came with that. And a lot of the cooking, especially cookies and cakes, you'd start seeing more German Kuchen and things like that.
So what might have been the typical Christmas feast in Michigan at that time? So we're talking like post-Civil War?
Yeah, late 1840s up through Victorian days. They did a big Christmas Day feast, and they would do turkeys, but also geese, roast geese or poached geese, hams. Sometimes they would do goose pie. There was a famous Christmas goose pie that was made of goose meat along with smoked tongue. They mixed lots of meats together to improve the flavor. But yeah, I know.
Nothing says Christmas cheer like smoked tongue.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, what about talk a little about the tree?
Christmas trees back in the early days were pretty dangerous. I mean, they used open candles on Christmas trees.
Boy, oh boy.
They also had really dangerous ornaments. Real popular were celluloid Christmas ornaments. These were invented, celluloid was invented in the 1850s
okay.
and brought to the States. you know, celluloid film.
Yeah, I'm thinking and, of that next
even
year.
Today, ping pong balls are made of celluloid.
Okay.
And if you're ever a kid and you want to do something really stupid and dangerous, you lit those and they go up with obnoxious black smoke. So imagine your trees festooned with those babies.
And drying out. I suppose they weren't as careful
oh,
as
yeah.
we might
oh,
be
no.
to
and then
keep
they used
it watered.
Aniline dye was real popular. It made of real deep purple and deep blue colors. So they had ornaments. They used aniline dye, which is like, let's decorate the tree with gasoline this year. You know, it was really dangerous.
Boy.
And there was recorded instances over and over about Christmas tree fires. So, and then they had illuminating gas. They didn't have electric lights. They had what they called illuminating gas. So it was gas nozzles that came out from the wall. And it was real popular to drape evergreens on these open gas things. And so when the kids came down for Christmas, the dad or mom would crank the gas way up for that Christmas experience.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with food writer Bill Loomis. We really call him our resident historian as we dig into what Christmas meals and Christmas celebrations were like in the Michigan of days past. Let's talk about St. Nick. When did Santa start showing up for children to climb up on his lap and whisper wishes?
Yeah, he started coming up during the Victorian days, too. That was the Germans coming around, so that was a big deal back then and exciting for the children.
From what I've heard, and I correct in this, that our popular image of Santa kind of came out of Coca-Cola ads in the 20s.
Yeah, if you look at the early Christmas cards or you look at early advertisements, he's kind of a scary-looking guy in a way. Mm-hmm. He's much more of a woods person, much more European-looking.
Thinner.
And thinner, exactly. If you look at the old Swiss or German images of Santa Claus, he's much more of a normal-looking person but with a big beard in a way. But a woodsman, he'll have a hooded coat on or something like that.
Okay.
But he's not a big, bushy, hefty fellow with a red nose and all that kind of stuff.
Now, we talk today and grumble about retailers pushing the Christmas season on us to boost sales, but this is nothing really new, is it?
No, that's been going on for long.
As long as there have been
retailers. As long as there are people, and Christmas and retailers, they've been doing the same thing. But I will say people seemed like there was more concern for, say, the counter people, the workers in the stores. They would say, there were articles almost every year, make sure to shop early so the counter people don't have to work 12-hour days at the counters. They worked long hours.
Mm.
And there were lines of people to get in the store. They could barely control the crowds downtown. You had to wait your turn to get in the building. It was so crowded.
Wow.
Yeah, right. But they had great displays, and you'll see pictures of the old days, and you see people lined up all along the sidewalk waiting to get in the store or waiting to get a bus and that kind of thing.
Very fun. Historian Bill Loomis. And if you care to prepare Christmas goose pie from 1828, Bill has kindly provided us with that and some other vintage Christmas recipes. And we have put them on our page for you. Just go to MichiganRadio.org and click on the stateside link. And you, too, can have Christmas goose pie. It sounds yummy. Bill, always a pleasure talking with you. And
thanks,
have a Merry
Cindy.
Christmas.
Yeah, you too.
For many of us, the word budget is not on our favorite words list. But as so many of us across Michigan discovered during the Great Recession, things can get mighty scary when there's a crunch and we don't have too much in the piggy bank. Enter my next guest, Detroit News personal finance editor Brian O'Connor. He writes the paper's Funny Money column. During the Great Recession, Brian and his family were feeling the pinch, so he decided to find out if his family could cut expenses by $1,000 every month. He's turned this experiment into a new book that he's titled The $1,000 Challenge, How One Family Slashed Its Budget Without Moving Under a Bridge or Living on Government Cheese. Brian O'Connor, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me, Cynthia.
So set the stage for us. Here you were writing on financial affairs for the Detroit News after you moved to Michigan in March of 2005, and that year is very important. It's just before things really began to drop out. So what happened to your family's finances?
Well, we wound up with a couple of different setbacks. 2005 was kind of the peak for the pre-recession in Michigan. And my wife moved up with my son, and she didn't go back to work for a few years because of dealing with some educational issues with my son. And by the time she could find a job, it was pretty much low-paying part-time work. But, you know, Michigan was already in that one-state recession that
yes.
we talk about since 2000. So the auto industry was already restructuring.
Mm-hmm.
Unemployment in the state was already much higher than the national average and never really recovered from the tech bubble going bust at the turn of the century. So things were already kind of ragged. And when the recession hit, in my job, I'm thinking, you know, we're headed towards 14% plus unemployment. People probably don't really need to know which credit card gives them the most frequent flyer points right now. If dad goes to work in the morning or mom goes to work in the morning and comes home unemployed and it's going to take 6 months to 2 years to find another job, mm-hmm. and that job is probably going to pay less anyway.
Yeah. How do you prepare for that?
Right. I mean, what's the one thing that you need to do? You need to stretch your cash so far that, you know, the eagle screams.
And Lincoln gets a headache.
And Lincoln gets a headache. And that's the thing. Even if you're going bankrupt, even if you're going into foreclosure, you need cash. It costs a lot of money to go bankrupt in America, a couple thousand dollars. So even if you're really in dire straits, you still need to conserve cash for going and finding a rental apartment, if you're losing your home, filing for bankruptcy, all these things. And of course, there are a bunch of other people, even though you can say, well, 85% of folks kept their jobs. They're making less. They've taken a pay cut. They've lost their overtime.
Yeah.
They're paying more for health care. Their college fund has got to be double the size they thought it was, or they've made nothing on their retirement investments for 10 years.
House is underwater, all of the, yeah.
Right.
It's a very familiar chant throughout the state.
You know, it really is one of those circumstances where cash is king. And my thought was, what do you do and how far do you need to go? And $1,000 made for a nice headline.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't practical for everybody. There are probably people listening to us who maybe don't even have $1,000 a month. But the idea was, what can you do and how far do you have to go?
Mm-hmm.
And part of what I found was that for a typical middle-class kind of family, there's a lot that you can get rid of that's not particularly going to involve twisting somebody's arm.
So you were trying to prove something to yourself as well as to your readers.
Right. I mean, I think one of the things is, does the, any of this advice work
mm-hmm.
that you're handing out in this newspaper, glibly handing out in this award-winning newspaper column? And so, you know, they say on Wall Street, you know, you have to eat your own dog food. And so, you know, I didn't want to eat dog food, so I needed to try my own advice. And it was interesting because it fell into a couple of categories. A lot of it was spending that was embarrassing to actually put in the newspaper.
Such as?
It was stupid spending.
Okay.
The most embarrassing one was I had kept an email account when I moved back from Florida to Detroit. So I could keep in touch with old freelance clients who
sure.
where that might be my only contact. Well, by the time I did this, I'd already been living here for 4 years and I hadn't opened the email account in 2.5 years.
And you've been paying for it.
And how was I paying for it? It was $25 a month on a credit card. If I had had to pull out the checkbook, write the check, find a stamp, realize I'd forgotten to buy stamps, go buy stamps,
mm-hmm.
you know, pay a late fee because I didn't have any stamps, find the envelopes, mail this thing every month.
You'd have killed that thing quick.
Right. I'd have taken that thing out behind the barn with a 22 right away, right? But no, and you have that. And for other people, it could be a gym membership. It can be something like a storage unit, which I also had. It can be a subscription to Cat Fancy when Fluffy died 2 years ago, all that kind of stuff. And you sit there and you try not to think, okay, $25 a month times 12 times 4 years.
Holy moly.
You know, that's
yeah.
a really nice vacation.
Yeah. So you start by, sounds like a good place to start is look at that credit card bill.
Right.
So go through that and take a very, very cold, hard look.
Oh, yeah. And that's if people don't want to do a budget. And most people, this is a big New Year's resolution, right?
Yeah.
It's one of the top two is get my finances in order.
Lose weight and get my finances in order.
So what do people do? If you need to lose weight, you just stand on a scale and you go, wow, I am a fat son of a gun, right? And that's all the feedback that you need. But everybody doesn't know if you have two people, two checkbooks, one paycheck, two paychecks,
mm-hmm.
automatic debits to this and that and the other thing. You don't really always know. And so people get stymied by trying to create a budget, going through all the statements and going through the bank statements and finding the stuff and downloading and what software do I use and do
yeah.
I use this website. And so most people won't do it. It's going to be like the guy who goes and buys a home gym and then it becomes a laundry hanger.
Yes.
Yeah. It's better to just take one bill, you know, take that MasterCard bill, take that cable bill and just, you know, x-ray that turkey,
mm-hmm.
you know, and go through everything. And if you do that, that'll start to get your spending in control because whatever reason you need a budget, you don't need a budget. You need more money for your goal. Either you can't pay your bills or you don't have enough to buy a new car or you don't have enough to put the kids through college.
Or take that vacation or
right.
retirement.
Right.
Fill
whatever
in the blank.
Your goal is, I need yeah. to put 10% more into retirement. just start focusing on that. Huh. Don't start making a color-coded spreadsheet that tracks every penny, you know, with the ruthlessness of a Kardashian looking for a new husband. You know, jump in and then let that progress carry you along. By the time I'm done, I have the 10 largest categories in my budget. I know what we'd been spending for the previous 9 months in that year. And now I have a pretty good feedback on what I'm actually spending. You're getting down into some pretty minor amounts of spending after you hit the top, after you take out your transportation, your housing, your groceries, your entertainment, your child care. You're getting into the points where you're probably not talking about a heck of a lot of money.
Yeah, it's stuff that you're not going to miss that much. Right. I'm speaking with writer Brian O'Connor, who is the Detroit News finance editor, and his book is A $1,000 Challenge, How One Family Slashed Its Budget Without Moving Under a Bridge or Living on Government Cheese. What was the hardest cut for you to make?
The hardest cuts, I found three different things. I found things that I was indifferent about, right? I didn't really care about which internet service provider I used.
Okay.
That was a really easy one. Utilities, cable, cell phone, telephone, long distance, all that. Those are very competitive things. People who have your business want to keep it. The people who don't
want to
get it. They're introducing new packages and calling plans and things all the time. That was literally three phone calls, about 90 minutes. I saved $140 a month. And I got $600 in temporary discounts or rebates, including a $200 gift card like a month before Christmas for switching my plans. So that was really easy. And that's another thing that I found is that if you focus on your recurring monthly bills, every dollar of spending that you cut is really $12 a year. Mm-hmm. The hardest stuff to cut is stuff that's behavioral. So entertainment, personal spending.
Getting my latte.
Getting your latte, getting your lunch, grocery shopping. That's the stuff where you have to be a little disciplined and, you know, you have to do it regularly. And if you're, you know, somebody like me who says, great, I'm going to cut my personal spending, I'll take my lunch, and you don't,
yeah.
Suddenly that category is not going to work.
Have your cuts lasted?
I would say that the bulk of them have. There were one or two that we didn't get to right away for logistical reasons. Life insurance we didn't reprice because we wanted to take care of some other health things to make sure that we could get the lowest. Like I said, the utility mm-hmm. stuff, that has been, you know, once you hang up the phone, you're done. You're saving money for the rest of your life.
I like the way in the $1,000 Challenge that you address several levels of trouble that people can get in. You have, you know, down. I am about to go insolvent and declare bankruptcy. You've got advice for them up to I want to take a vacation. How do I? So basically what I'm hearing is plug all those little minuscule holes in the bucket that
right.
cause that leaking.
It just depends on how serious you want to get or how serious you need to get. I think for a lot of us people who haven't had a raise, most people aren't back to where they were in 2005 or 2006. So we're not in a crisis, but we're not where we thought we'd be. Yeah. And you can get to that point, I'm in my 50s, where you kind of go, man, how can I not afford this? You know, I have a good job. I have a good career. Well, you know, we've been through the worst recession in 80 years and another jobless recovery 8 years before that. So a lot of us are catching up, and this is one way to catch up. But it's, you know, people will say, well, I've gotten some emails from people who said, because I mentioned my boat maintenance. Well, it's a 30-year-old boat.
So you we're not talking big yacht on the St. Clair River.
Right. And I get these kind of sneering emails that go, well, I wish I had a boat to cut out of my budget. You know, and it's all about whatever your priorities are, whether it's a 30-year-old
yacht.
Boat or whether it's I've got to be able to keep the lights on until I get evicted.
Yeah.
And I can move in with my aunt, whatever. It's your money, and you should decide what to do and where it should go.
The book is The $1,000 Challenge, How One Family Slashed Its Budget Without Moving Under a Bridge or Living on Government Cheese by Brian J. O'Connor. And pleasure to meet you, and thanks so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was certainly a fiery, impassioned, emotional scene at the state capitol 1 year ago this month. That's when the GOP-led lame duck legislature rammed through the right-to-work law, and with Governor Snyder's signature, Michigan became the nation's 24th right-to-work state. The laws took effect in March, making it illegal to force workers to pay union dues as a condition of employment. So 1 year later, what do our local government leaders think about right to work? That was the focus of the latest Michigan Public Policy Survey, done by the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy at the University of Michigan. Tom Ivacco is the program manager. Welcome back.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks.
Well, give us the overall view then. What do local leaders think about right to work?
Well, overall, 47%, just less than half of Michigan's local government leaders basically support the new law as it applies to public sector labor unions.
Mm-hmm.
22% oppose it outright. And roughly about a third or so really aren't quite sure. They haven't taken a stance. They see pros and cons.
That actually surprises me that the number of undecideds is that large. Did it surprise you?
Yeah, actually, for our surveys, that is a very high percentage. Yeah. A lot of times we'll get, you know, 10% or so of local officials saying, yeah, I'm not quite sure on this issue. This is a pretty big percentage.
Okay. Particularly when you have such a large percentage, you know, in support and then a small percentage against, you would just think somehow that they would have fallen more strongly on one side of the fence or the other.
Yeah, I think that's right. And especially for such an emotional issue for so many people.
Yeah. Now, did support pretty much follow along party lines?
It does, very strongly. 60% of Republican local leaders support the right to work law. Only 9% of them oppose it. It's basically flipped for Democratic local leaders. 21% support it, 53% oppose it. And independent local leaders are basically right in the middle. 45% support the right to work law, 22% oppose.
Okay. Now, we know the law allows exemptions for police and fire unions. How is that viewed by local leaders?
There's less support for these police and fire exemptions than there is for the law itself. Overall, only 26% of local leaders support these exemptions, and 33% oppose them. And again, there are partisan differences, but here they're flipped.
Yes.
This time, Democratic local leaders support the exemptions, and Republican local leaders are less supportive.
Do they give you any sense? Do you have an idea why they may have that opposition?
No. Actually, unfortunately, we didn't have enough space on the survey to ask why they might feel this way. You know, we can speculate a little bit. As we know, Republicans in general tend to support right to work. And so perhaps it's just the case that they oppose these exemptions because they think everybody should be subject to right to work
and perhaps concerned that amongst their pool of city employees there might be some looking at the exemptions that the police and fire get and say, hey, wait a minute.
That's right. Among support for these exemptions is even lower in jurisdictions that have public sector unions, among all kinds of leaders, Republicans, independents, and Democrats. And so there we think it's probably a case of being concerned about inequalities among all of their employees and not wanting to see different employees subject to different kinds of laws.
Did you hear or to get any sense of whether or not these leaders that feel that right to work was good for their communities, fiscally speaking?
Well, very few local leaders really think that this law is going to have a big impact in their jurisdictions. We asked what they thought, what kind of impact it would have on the fiscal health of their jurisdiction. Overall, only 23% think it's going to have a positive impact. Really small number.
Again, and considering how it was sold by Republican lawmakers and Governor Snyder, this will help business, you would think somehow that might have connected, but it doesn't seem to be with on the local level.
Yeah, we asked local leaders if they thought that this right to work legislation was going to help their jurisdictions attract or retain businesses into their communities. Overall, 31% think it'll have a positive impact. 24% think it'll have no impact. So really not a game changer in the view of local leaders.
No, and again, when we hearken back to think of the scenes about a year ago with the emotion behind this and all the passion, that surprises me. What about you? What surprised you?
I think the thing that surprised us the most was, so we asked about a range of potential impacts from this law. And the issue that had the most concern among local leaders was the potential for this law to have a negative impact on their relationships with their own employee unions. We've done a number of surveys over the last few years that have found local leaders have increasingly positive views of the impact of their own unions on their own jurisdictions. And in terms of the right to work, this was the one issue that had a little more concern than others among local leaders, that it could start to have a negative impact on relationships.
Even though you had nearly half supporting right to work, there was still concern that it would basically kind of poison the well, if you will,
That's right.
with their local unions.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the case among all stripes, Republicans, Independents, and Democrats. All are a little more worried about potential outcome on local labor relations than it having the potential positive impact.
Very interesting. We're looking at the latest Michigan Public Policy Survey done by the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy. At the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan, we have program manager Tom Evacco here kind of crunching all these numbers and telling us what the survey reveals. What do you think, Tom, that these findings are telling us about possible outcomes of labor negotiations on the local level?
First of all, only about a quarter of Michigan's local governments have a public sector labor union. So that probably is going to limit the impact statewide of this right to work legislation. But among these jurisdictions that do have labor unions, 73% last year conducted negotiations with their unions. And the most common topic was fringe benefits. And the most common outcome was labor unions making concessions back to the jurisdiction. Again, on pay rate discussions and negotiations, the most common outcome was labor unions making concessions. And this has been the case for a couple of years now. And so we've seen kind of a shifting of outcomes and power a little more towards the administration side, a little further away from the labor union side. And so right to work here, you know, is one new development. Whether or not it's going to push that needle significantly, it's hard to tell because that needle has been moving already.
And we've kind of seen that in state law.
That's right. Under Governor Snyder and the new Republican majority over the last couple of years, a number of laws have been implemented that also are shifting the balance of power away from labor unions. Laws like Public Act 152, the Economic Vitality Incentive Program, which is basically revenue sharing for local governments, Public Act 312, and some others. These are all shifting the balance of power towards jurisdictions. So Public Act 312, for instance, is a binding arbitration law. And it's primarily for police and fire unions. And in the past, when the administration and the unions couldn't come to an agreement, they went to binding arbitration. And most of the outcomes there tended to favor the unions. This change in state law makes the arbitrator have to take into account the ability of the jurisdiction to pay as the primary factor in coming up with an outcome. And so that's shifting the balance of power.
Do you see these views of local leaders regarding right to work working their way into the mindset of the public, of the voting public?
Well, that's going to be an interesting question. One thing about this law was when it was put into effect, existing contracts at the local level were grandfathered in. So it's going to have a different impact on different communities over time as existing contracts expire. So I think we'll see, you know, kind of a rollout of how this impacts different communities over time. Whether or not local citizens are, you know, are kind of paying attention to what their local government leaders think about it, not quite sure.
There has been a lot of discussion among pundits about just how much of an issue right to work will be in the 2014 election, of course, when Governor Snyder's up for re-election, as is the entire state House and Senate. Do these results give you any sense of how this issue could play come next November?
I think, if anything, these results seem to say this may not be as big of an issue as it looked like it was going to be a year ago. The emotions were so high a year ago across the state. These results from local leaders are really kind of a dispassionate, logical look at what kind of impact this is going to have. Of course, you know, as we saw, there are still, you know, some partisan, maybe emotional views even among local leaders. But, you know, overall, this appears to be kind of a, you know, an issue that's just not resonating that big among local leaders.
And we've kind of heard that when we were doing a look back. It wasn't as what we heard from MSU economist Charlie Ballard. It wasn't as horrible as its critics thought. And in so far, it has not been as stellar as the supporters thought. So it's kind of seems to be evening out. And I think I hear that reflected in what you found.
I think that's exactly how local leaders overall view this. Certainly, there are going to be, you know, individual local leaders who think it's going to be, you know, best thing since sliced bread, and others who think it's going to be just a disaster. But when we look statewide, I think, you know, as you've described it, as Charlie Ballard predicted it, I think local leaders are there. It'll have some impact. It'll take some time to play out. Probably not a major impact one way or the other.
Tom Evacco is the program manager for the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy at the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Always great to see you. Have a very Merry Christmas. Great holidays.
Thank you. You too, Cindy.
Starting next month, the Committee to Restore Michigan's Part-Time Legislature says they'll be looking for your signatures. They have 6 months to gather hundreds of thousands of voter signatures to get a big question on the November 2014 ballot. And that question is, Should we amend Michigan's constitution to switch our state back to a part-time legislature? We'll look at both sides of this issue. Today, we welcome a Republican strategist who believes the proposal is not in Michigan's best interest. He's a columnist for the Morning Sun and a public affairs consultant. Dennis Lennox, welcome back to Stateside.
Hey.
So when you first heard the proposal, what was your understanding of exactly what that would mean?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of rhetoric in the last few years, particularly from those on the right, saying we need to have a part-time legislature in Michigan. But it's really kind of unclear exactly what they want to propose and actually how it would truly benefit the state, because when you start running down the list, I don't see any positives.
What is your sense when you hear this debate? What have you digested and taken away as the reasons, the arguments for having a part-time legislature?
Well, the big argument that the proponents will make is that it's going to somehow rein in government and save a bunch of taxpayer money. I happen to think both those arguments are rubbish, ultimately for the simple fact that, well, you're making the people's voice, because the legislature is the people's voice part-time. The governor, the civil servant bureaucrats, and the judiciary will remain full-time. So I think that's unfair, and I think it will greatly damage our system of, you know, democratic government in this country and in this state.
So are you saying checks and balances will all be thrown out of whack?
Absolutely. I mean, how can you say we're going to make the legislature part-time and keep the governor full-time, keep the civil servants full-time, and keep the judiciary full-time? Now, the bureaucrats in Lansing are probably getting pretty excited about all this talk. I mean, the idea of having pesky legislators, you know, hanging out in their district for 10 months out of the year without any political power is probably something bureaucrats dream of. But if you're the guy on Main Street looking for action from Lansing to rein in the bureaucracy, you know, you're the small business owner who's struggling to get that permit, this is a bad thing.
Now, Dennis, you can't deny there are many folks walking on main streets all over Michigan who are Democrat, Republican, Independent, doesn't matter, who are really pretty frustrated with the way state government in Michigan is being run now. Why not try to kind of upset things and shake things up and reform things?
Well, I mean, there's no question that Lansing clearly has had her challenges over the years. The problem, though, is as we've seen with term limits, you know, the voters approved term limits in 1992, and by all accounts, Republican, Democrat, Independent, that term limits haven't worked in this state. In fact, most people will say it's made things in Lansing worse. So, you know, giving a legislator, say, 2 months to do their job combined with term limits, that's a recipe for disaster. I mean, could you imagine going into the emergency room and having, you know, life-saving heart surgery and finding out the surgeon only does it, you know, a month or two out of the year, and he's only been doing it for a couple of years?
Well, let me ask you this. With Michigan being one of only 10 states with some sort of full-time legislature, clearly other states are trying different options, Dennis. So are you against the entire idea of a part-time legislature, or is it this version being pushed by the committee that you're opposed to?
Well, it also depends how you define what a part-time legislature is. You know, there really is no generally accepted definition. For example, states like Texas and Alabama and some of these other states that the proponents like to cite, while they're part-time, they're really penals, part-time in name only. They meet for 60 days or 90 days, but all the committee meetings are held outside of that time period. All the constituent services outside of that time period. You know, in Michigan, we like to have our legislators available at town hall forums and at office hours. So there would be some cultural changes as well that I don't think the people would like if their legislature, if their legislator suddenly said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I'm on vacation for 10 more months. Call me back up in January." But again, the definition of a part-time legislature, it's really not quite clear what that would really mean. Would that mean that all the committees would meet in the summertime? If that's the case, there would have to be per diem payments, which most of these other states provide. And when you factor that into the equation, there's really no cost savings.
Have you seen it work well in other states?
Well, you know, it's difficult to compare a state like Alabama with a state like Michigan or a state like Texas with a state like Michigan. Sure, the economy's great in Texas, but again, their legislature has special sessions. They have committee meetings in between the sessions. In Michigan, we don't have that tradition. So it's very difficult. I would say it's comparing apples and oranges. You know, Lansing has its problems, but radically altering the Constitution, and in this case, neutering the people's voice, probably isn't a good thing in the long run.
What kind of candidates do you think this system would draw? I guess if you're looking at the 60 days or 90 days, is it 90 days that they would? Is it fuzzy?
I've seen different figures out there, both 60 and 90 days. Again, that's why I said it's really not totally clear what these people are proposing.
And I guess one would have to wonder how that would fit in anyone's life to be able to say to the boss, all right, well, I'm working for you, but then from, say, January to whenever, I'm in Lansing.
Well, not only that, but what about ethics concerns? I mean, I see situations where, you know, we already know in Michigan there's not a lot of disclosure requirements. You know, for example, members of Congress in Washington, you know, have to disclose if they have outside income or investments, things of that nature. We don't have those requirements at the legislative level in Lansing. So imagine if you have somebody that's only doing the job for a month or two out of the year and they have full-time employment elsewhere. There would be matters that would arise in the legislature where they have certainly an indirect, if not a direct, conflict of interest. And under the present laws, there would be no disclosure requirements. I think that's troubling. But it also gets back to what you said. Who's going to be able to do the job? I see a situation where it's basically going to be very rich people, people who have a job maybe with a labor union or a think tank or some sort of big lobby group in town, or with no disrespect to retired people, senior citizens.
Dennis Lennox, Republican strategist, speaking out against the proposal that's being offered by the Committee to Restore Michigan's Part-Time Legislature. Dennis, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, as always. I appreciate it.
And tomorrow we will hear from Norm Kamerad, who is chairman of the Committee to Restore Michigan's Part-Time Legislature. That will be tomorrow afternoon on Stateside. What do you think? Part-time legislature, yes or no? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And, of course, we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And you can always find us on the website, michiganradio.org. And just click the link that says Stateside. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tenniskatter, and John K. Wilson. This program's a production of